Thank you all for standing by. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. All participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session for today's conference. At that time, you may press star one on your phone to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jackie Glaze. You may begin.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and welcome everyone to today's Allstate call. I'll now turn to Calder, and he'll provide opening remarks and share today's highlights for the discussion. Calder?
Thanks, Jackie. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us. We hope everyone had a great 4th of July break and got a little rest. Now we're happy to be resuming our weekly call this week. During our most recent Allstate call 2 weeks ago, we received really many great questions that we ran out of time and were unable to address. A lot of these questions covered a few major topic areas, including those that were addressed in our most recent batch of FAQs around retainer payments, Appendix Ks, as well as some key dates and other maintenance of effort requirements for the enhanced FMAP. So for the first portion of today's call, we're going to continue the Q&A and answer questions that we received that we were not able to get to during our last call. And then for the second portion of the call, our team is going to provide a brief update on the Medicaid and CHIP distribution of the Provider Relief Fund, and then open up the line to give and take questions, more questions on our latest batch of FAQs that was issued back on June 30th. Just a few reminders first before we begin with our presentations. I want to touch on one of the recurring questions that we've received regarding the extension of the public health emergency. As you may know, the decision to extend the PHE is made by the Secretary of HHS, and Secretary Azar and the Vice President recently met with governors and provided assurances that the PHE will be extended. We're awaiting the formal extension, but we're confident that the PHE will be extended beyond the end of July, and we'll continue to keep you updated as we get official word of that. I also wanted to provide additional information about some just-released guidance. Today, we issued a letter to state Medicaid directors that formally extends the time frame for demonstrating compliance with the home and community-based settings final regulation. This guidance extends that timeline for one additional year by which states must ensure that settings furnished using Medicaid-funded HCVS services comply with the settings criteria. So, in effect, the timeline is extended, the deadline is extended from March 17, 2020 to March 17, 2023. And this extension, of course, was driven by the disruptions to HCVS reform efforts that the public health emergency has caused. And we recognize that not only has the PHE demanded the full focus of state resources, it's also impacted the way providers deliver care. And so we have published this guidance with the extension, along with some frequently asked questions that have been updated to provide more technical information that I want to call to your attention as well. And finally, the letter encourages states to continue making consistent progress in not only achieving compliance with the setting rule, but also the larger goals of rebalancing in our long-term care programs to increase the availability of person-centered individualized supports. So with that, I will turn things over to Melissa Harris to answer the questions related to retainer payments that we didn't get to last time. Melissa?
Thanks, Calder. So this is Melissa, and I thought what I'd do is provide a little bit of a refresher on the retainer payment framework that we published in our last round of FAQs. We talked about this briefly on our last call, but the document was not formally published yet, and so you all didn't have the benefit of having anything in front of you as we were providing this overview. So I thought I would do it again quickly. Hopefully now you've had some time to digest the FAQ language. And so I'll reiterate that when we're talking about retainer payments, we're talking about a couple of different types of scenarios. Certainly now in the public health emergency, they are front of mind in as being a tool to protect the solvency of home and community-based services providers, and that continues. But retainer payments are not limited to payments or periods of disaster. Retainer payments really got their start in a 2000 state Medicaid director letter, and those parameters are still in effect today. That guidance talked about retainer payments up to 30 days. It was the lesser of 30 days or the number of days in which a state has nursing facility bed hold days articulated in their state plan. And that type of retainer payment is available all the time. We don't need to be in a period of a public health emergency or have any kind of disaster or official declaration. So retainer payments, according to the parameters of the 2000 State Medicaid Director letter, are available as that letter articulated for 1915C waivers and as we articulated in this new FAQ document under state plan options in 1915I and 1915K. So that's one parameter to keep in mind in terms of the permanent availability of retainer payments. But it is wise to remember that in that scenario, the time amount and the number of days of retainer payments is limited to the number of nursing facility bed hold days in that state. So let's move now to retainer payments in periods of disaster or a public health emergency like we're in now. States have come to us in the 1915C waiver world over time and said that they needed to utilize more than one period of retainer payments in periods of disaster because the time frames were such that more than one period was necessary to ensure financial solvency or to protect financial solvency. And so CMS had been authorizing more than one period of retainer payments in those disaster periods. So that has also been continued in these FAQs. You'll note that there is an upper limit of 90 days or three periods of 30 days each in periods of disaster. And that 90-day time frame is firm. So we are talking about retainer payments for up to and including 90 days in periods of disaster under the 1915C waiver and under the 1915I state plan and the 1915K state plan. The FAQs also walk through some guardrails that are new and that apply to multiple periods of retainer payments. And so those retainer payments really talk about the expectations that CMS has of states and providers who avail themselves of multiple periods of retainer payments. And the guardrails go into what we hope is sufficient detail to give states and providers some operationalizing guidance. But we've also been getting some questions from stakeholders about what CMS means by some of the phrases in the guardrails. So we'll try to hit some of those questions briefly. But in essence, we're making sure that retainer payments are limited to a reasonable amount and in no case should be more than the payment the provider was receiving under Medicaid had they been delivering services in a normal environment. If a provider was receiving X amount of dollars for the provision of Medicaid services, that is the cap at which the retainer payments have to be limited. They can't exceed that amount. States also have the ability to set a retainer payment at less than what they were providing as reimbursement for delivering a service. And so you've got that specifically listed in the FAQ language. There's also the ability for a state to say that retainer payments will not be made to a particular setting unless or until attendance falls below a specific threshold of typical enrollment. And the 75% that we have in the FAQ is just an example. But it's to notify states that there is some discretion there in terms of the amount of payment and the providers or the circumstances in which a retainer payment kicks in, but there is that cap that can't be exceeded, and that is what the provider would have received for the delivery of services. We've also got some guardrails around duplicate payments. There's a lot of money that is available now to providers for COVID relief. And these guardrails tried to name some of them explicitly, but then we also said that states and providers should be aware of the purposes for which other payment sources are being utilized and that retainer payments should not be going to for a purpose that has already been earmarked by another funding source. This is all to make sure that payments are being used efficiently and economically, and Medicaid funding in the form of a retainer payment is not going to duplicate another purpose that already has funding associated with it. Another guardrail is particularly important as it relates to staffing levels and the ability of the provider to continue delivering services. And the guardrail states that a state must require an attestation from a provider receiving retainer payments that it will not lay off staff and maintain wages at existing levels. That's really critical to make sure that beneficiaries are still able to receive services because there are enough direct service workers, et cetera, employed to furnish those services. And then also the final guardrail is that agency or providers receiving retainer payments cannot, together with other funding streams, make more money than they would have been making in typical circumstances when they are furnishing services, at least in terms of Medicaid revenue. So the retainer payment, you know, cannot put the provider above what kind of Medicaid revenue the provider would have received absent the public health emergency. We've gotten a couple of questions, about some of the operational aspects of this, how a state elects retainer payments for both emergency periods and regular periods. The FAQs provide some guidance around the disaster SPA availability and the Appendix K availability for COVID-related multiple periods of retainer payment. A state who wants to make use of typical retainer payments, which would be the lesser of 30 days or the number of nursing facility bed hold days, can add those retainer payments to their underlying state plans or their underlying waivers. They don't need to file one of the emergency authorities. Those emergency authorities are available for the multiple periods of disaster-related retainer payments. And certainly CMS is available for technical assistance to states as they're determining the types and the durations of retainer payments and what kind of filings to make. I'll end here by mentioning a couple of things, a couple of questions that we've been getting on those guardrails around duplicate funding streams. Understanding that this might have take on some variation across different agencies that might have different funding streams coming into them, it might be better to have a individual technical assistance conversation with the state so we can get the nuances of an individual example. One of the questions we'd received was whether a line of credit or an owner giving a personal loan to a provider would count as another funding stream. That answer is no. We're talking about public funding streams here. The Medicaid-funded retainer payments could not be used to duplicate another public funding stream. And then the last thing I'll say is that those same lines of credit, personal loans, also would not be treated as revenue or counted as revenue in determining the cap at which a retainer payment cannot put a provider organization vis-a-vis their revenue that they were receiving prior to the public health emergency. So all of this is to say there's a lot of different variations on the themes of these questions that we're getting. It's probably best to handle them on a one-on-one basis, but we've received a few in the few days since the questions have been on the street, so we thought we would try to head off some of these. But our Division of Long-Term Services and Supports and our Division of Benefits and Coverage are available to provide additional additional opportunities of technical assistance for you, and appreciate your patience as we worked to nail down all of these policy nuances. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Ralph Lawler, who's going to talk about some additional information on the Appendix Ks, and then we'll be available at the end for questions. Thanks.
So with regard to the Appendix Ks, it will be important for the states that are choosing to use this option of multiple up to three episodes of the retainer payments to document that in an updated Appendix K application. If that is the only change you were making, you would submit the cover page with the date identifying the waivers and adding the information that it is additive to the current waiver, to the current Appendix K. And then in the area of the retainer payments, you would include that the state is choosing the option of rendering multiple periods or episodes, up to three, set the limit, and then indicate the guardrails and enumerate the guardrails to ensure that they are inside the Appendix K, and any other limitations and or processes that you want to document that you are going to have your providers follow for this process should be included in that application. And I think that is the most important thing that I would highlight here for folks who are considering using the multiple episodes.
Thank you, Ralph. So we'll now turn to Stephanie Kaminsky, and she'll share some information on the maintenance of effort. Stephanie?
Right. Thank you, Jackie. So 2 weeks ago when we spoke, we had a slide deck, and we shared with folks some important termination dates related to the authority in the Families First Coronavirus Response Act related to 6008B. At that time, we stated and we shared a slide that showed that 6008B1, the authority that requires states who want the 6.2% increased FMAP to maintain eligibility standards, methodologies, or procedures, will expire the last day of the calendar quarter in which the PHE ends. 6000B2, which requires states who want that FMAP bump to not charge premiums that exceed those that were in place as of January 1, 2020, also expires the last day of the calendar quarter in which the PHE ends. Then 6008B3, the provision that we've spent quite a bit of time talking about here, which requires states not to terminate individuals from Medicaid if the individuals were enrolled in the program as of the date of the beginning of the emergency. That provision expires the last day of the month in which the PHE ends, not the last day of the calendar quarter, but rather the last day of the month in which the PHE ends. And finally, 6008D4, which is the provision that requires states who want that FMAP bump to cover testing services and treatments for COVID-19 without imposing a copay, that provision expires the last day of the calendar quarter in which the PHE ends. So we have three that expire the last day of the calendar quarter, and one, the 6008B3, that expires the last day of the month in which the PHE ends. One person asked after the call, well, why is that the case? What is the authority that creates this difference, this variation? And I would just point folks to the actual FFCRA, Families First Coronavirus Response Act, 6008B language. In that statutory text, you can see the different end dates, and specifically for B3, it says that it ends the last day of the month in which the emergency period ends. So we are really just bringing you the statute in a different form here, and you can certainly check there for more verification. In addition, we had the question, how do states handle the fact that the requirement for cost sharing required for the increased FMAP does not match the end date of the disaster SPAs? In other words, the disaster SPAs will end when the PHE ends, but there's this requirement for the cost-sharing exemption for COVID testing and treatments to continue until the last day of the calendar quarter in which the PHE ends. And where we have landed with respect to that question is that, yes, states have to continue that exemption through the last day of the calendar quarter of the PHE, that the PHE ends. But we are not requiring states to submit new SPAs to extend the cost-sharing exemption through the last day of the quarter in which the PHE ends. However, as states draw funds from the increased FMAP account in the payment management system, each state will be attesting that it is eligible for the increased FMAP, that the expenditures for which it is drawing funds are those for which the increased FMAP is applicable, and that the conditions under which the increased FMAP is available are met. So that is a normal course of business, and that will continue as a type of attestation that the states are continuing to apply that exemption through the end of the calendar quarter that the PHE ends. We had a specific question about the premium payment authority. That was 6008B2, which requires that states not charge higher premiums than they were charging as of January 1 during the PHE. And we wanted to just reiterate that the limitation on premium charges in Section 6008B2 ends, again, on the last day of the quarter in which the PHE ends. And finally, we had another question that was around the definition of uninsured. The question was specifically if a patient who needs a COVID-19 test has Medicare Part A only and doesn't have Medicaid, not a dual eligible, can the provider or the lab be reimbursed for the COVID test either by the state's 23 group, the optional COVID testing group that some states have adopted, or from the HRSA COVID-19 claims reimbursement to healthcare providers and facilities for testing and treatment of the uninsured program, the HRSA fund for the uninsured? And our answer, unfortunately, is no. If a person has Medicare Part A, they are considered insured. And those two sources of funding are truly for individuals who are uninsured by the definition in the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. Having Part A Medicare does not fall within the definition in the statute. So those were just some follow-up questions that came from our presentation 2 weeks ago. And as I mentioned then, we do intend to put out a couple of FAQs around these termination dates, so stay tuned for those. And with that, I'll turn it back to Jackie.
Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you, Ralph and Melissa, for your presentations. We're ready now to move on to Jen Bowden, and she's going to provide an update on the Provider Relief Fund. Jen?
Thanks, Jackie, and hi, everyone. It's nice to speak with you all. So I have just a few brief updates on the Provider Relief Fund. So first, as a reminder, provider applications for payments under the Medicaid and CHIP distribution of the Provider Relief Fund are due on July 20th. This deadline is particularly important to highlight and note because with less than a week left remaining in the application period, relatively few Medicaid and CHIP providers have applied for payments under the Medicaid and CHIP distribution. Specifically, as of last Friday, July 10th, in most states, less than 2% of the Medicaid and CHIP providers that we think are eligible had applied for a payment, and the highest application rate in any state was only 6.5%. Again, the application deadline for the Medicaid and CHIP distribution is July 20th, and we would really appreciate your support and assistance in getting the word out to your providers and encouraging them to apply. Second, we want to remind states and territories to return their validation files to HRSA as quickly as possible. As you may be aware, HRSA has received applications from some providers that were not included on the files provided by states and territories. Unfortunately, HRSA is not able to process payments for providers until they have been validated as Medicaid and CHIP providers in good standing. Returning the validation files in a timely way will allow HRSA to process these applications and make the payments to eligible providers as quickly as possible. And lastly, we wanted to make sure that you are aware that HHS recently announced additional provider relief fund distributions, including an additional $3 billion for 215 safety net hospitals that didn't previously qualify for the safety net hospital distribution, $1 billion for certain rural hospitals and hospitals from small metropolitan areas that didn't apply for the rural distribution, and a separate distribution for dentists that were not previously eligible to apply for payment under either the general distribution or the Medicaid CHIP distribution. If you'd like more information on these or other provider relief fund distributions, I would encourage you to visit HHS's provider relief fund website at hhs.gov/provider relief. That's all one word. Again, that's hhs.gov/provider relief. And with that, I will turn it back to Jackie.
Thank you, Jen. So we're ready now to take any questions from the audience. If you have questions on the information that was shared today or any other questions, we're ready to take them now. So, operator, would you please open the lines at this time?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone and speak your name clearly when prompted. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star 2. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone. One moment as we wait for any questions.
Greg Woods.
Our first question comes from Greg Woods. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Greg Woods from New Jersey Medicaid. I had a quick question around the guardrails around the Appendix K retainer payments. I think I heard the presenter say a couple of times that the guardrail around retainer payments not exceeding normal revenue is specific to Medicaid revenue. I did not see that in the FAQs and wanted to get clarification whether we should be looking at Medicaid revenue specifically or revenue more generally.
Hi, this is Melissa Harris. I'm getting a little bit of an echo, so apologies if this will sound a little disjointed. You're right. We did not qualify the word revenue in the FAQs. We just said that retainer payments cannot put the provider in excess of the amount of revenue that they received for the last full quarter. We're clarifying here that that really means Medicaid revenue. That should be a much more identifiable amount to be aware of. Retainer payments, does not exceed. But the goal of establishing this Medicaid policy for retainer payments is to make sure that the retainer payment does not bring the reimbursement to a provider more than Medicaid would have been reimbursing that provider in the absence of this public health emergency. So I think that's helpful.
Hi, this is Emily Costello. Jackie, can we check with the secretary? There's a lot of feedback.
Yes, I was calling.
Can we check if that echo is still present? It sounds like it may be gone.
I am still on.
Why don't we? It sounds like the echo may be gone. Why don't we try proceeding to the next question?
Hello. If you're a speaker and you have your phone on speaker, if you could use your headset, that might work.
And all speakers who are not speaking should make sure that they're manually muted.
And if you would like to mute your line, please press star 6. Our next question comes from Ushomo Nwobara from Louisiana Department of Health. Your line is now open.
Thank you, ma'am. That's my question. The FAQ's last update was June 30th. Is there a way we can tell when an update has been added? I mean, it doesn't tell us that. We had one in May, we had one in April, but it doesn't tell us exactly what new items has been added. Is there a way we can know that, or is there a way we can try to figure out what the new items are? Please.
Hello? I believe the question is to how to tell which questions are new in the most recent batch of FAQs. So we do have a way of telling that. If the team can just explain how to do that.
How do I do that? How do I know?
No, I'm asking my team to explain. Go ahead. Maybe lost some folks.
I'm here.
Calder, I think this is Ralph.
Go ahead, Ralph.
And I think the FAQs that were just released all contain new information in them. Certainly the retainer payment discussion that starts on page 26 is all new material.
Yeah, there's a link on Medicaid.gov. And it specifically says, it's got a release date of June 30th, and it's just the new FAQs. So they also have been integrated into the, document with all FAQs, but there is a standalone document on Medicaid.gov.
Okay, please. Could you send me the link or something I can use?
Can you provide your name, and we'll definitely do that.
Okay. My name is Uchioma Mabara. Let me spell it for you, please.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes.
Okay. U as umbrella, C like Charles, H like Henry, E like Edward, O like Oscar, M like Mary, A apple. That's my first name. Last name is N like Nancy, W, William, A, Apple, G, Good, B, Boy, A, Apple, R, Randy, and A, Apple.
Okay, thank you. And what state are you with?
I'm with Louisiana Department of Health.
Got it. Thank you so much. Okay, operator, we're ready for the next question, please.
Our next question comes from Damon. Your line is now open.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Damon Terzaghi with Advancing States. And this question is, I believe, for Melissa and Ralph. You talked a little bit about the new policies and guardrails in effect for the retainer payments. And as I'm sure you know, some states had already been leveraging the flexibility to provide multiple rounds of retainer payments. And I'm curious what you anticipate the policies being to apply those guardrails or not to apply those guardrails to providers that may have already received more than one round of the 30 days of retainer payments.
Thanks, Damon. This is Melissa, and I'll take a shot and then invite others to weigh in. So there's a few different categories of retainer payments, multiple periods of retainer payments, one being, the request that CMS received very early in the public health emergency, where states were aware based on prior disasters that they could receive multiple periods of retainer payments. And so states requested and CMS approved those retainer payments prior to these FAQs coming out. So obviously these guardrails would not apply to those retainer payments. Separately, we've got states that are now kind of with these FAQs coming to understand that retainer payments are now available in the 1915I and the 1915K and are going to be requesting technical assistance from us to newly implement retainer payments in those state plan authorities. Those obviously would be for prospective periods or they could be retroactive, but they would be done with the understanding that these guardrails are in effect. And so we would expect the guardrails to adhere to those retainer payments for multiple periods. The stickier issue is for the 1915C waiver for a state that might be in negotiations right now with CMS to implement retainer payments with the retroactive effective date, but, you know, the state is coming to us now saying this is something I'd like new CMS approval to do now, and now the FAQs are on the street, as are the guardrails. So, you know, we've had some conversations about this internally. I think we would talk to the state about expectations of having the guardrails apply to those retainer payments, even though they're, we understand they'd be going back in time and you can't, you know, change past behavior. I think our goal would be to have them apply to newly approved retainer payments, even for prior periods. But we would want to talk to a state to figure out if there are any, you know, potential rough edges with that. But it's a valid question.
Thank you, Melissa. So just to summarize, for states that had already done it, the guardrails would not apply. For states that are prospectively applying them, they would apply. And for states that had been doing it without approval but are seeking a retroactive approval date, that would be that discussion negotiation comes in, but you would like to see them in place if at all possible.
So that, you got a little garbled in that, and so I'm going to try to re-summarize what I said. A retainer payment for multiple periods that CMS already approved would not be held to the guardrails. Retainer payments that CMS is now talking to a state about newly approving, even for prior periods, we would want to have a conversation to see how those guardrails could be applied. I think it's our hope slash expectation that they would be applied. That's talking about the for 1915C, kind of a whole new day for retainer payments for 1915I and K. And so our expectation would be that any multiple period retainer payment would come under those guardrails going forward.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Yep.
I would add for clarification that it was a small number of states that Melissa is referring to in the 1915C Appendix case. We have actively been reaching out to those states. And I would also point out that many states in their Appendix K application included guardrails that ensured that the providers were not receiving double funding for the same purpose and the same payment. So I think that there is less of a issue here than you might otherwise think apply.
Thanks, Ralph. We're ready for the next question, please. Operator.
Our next question comes from Jason Korn. Your line is now open.
Thank you. We accessed retainer payments early on in March. My question surrounds the guardrail requiring an attestation that it will not lay off staff and will maintain wages at existing levels. We set our retainer payment level at 80% of what a provider would be able to bill. Expectantly, providers asked, how can we then retain staff at 100% and pay them at 100% when we are only receiving 80%? Is there any guidance or any recommendations on how to respond?
This is Melissa, and I would say that, you know, the guardrails for these Medicaid retainer payments are in recognition that we are one source of funding among several. And so it's very hard for us at the federal level to understand what variety of funding sources might be in play in a particular state with a particular provider. And so those guardrails are meant to say that in the Medicaid space, you know, there are bright lines that the amount of a retainer payment can't cross. States have discretion up to those bright lines in determining, you know, what kind of resources to make available to HCBS providers. And so, you know, there are a lot of variations on how a state can make that happen in terms of the dollar amount of the retainer payment up to that threshold of what the provider was receiving in the quarter prior to the public health emergency, the types of providers to be receiving retainer payments. You know, this is all at state option. The piece about the retention of staff is to make sure that, you know, one of the key aspects of making sure beneficiaries have their services continue to be available to them is based on the need to recruit and retain staff. And if a provider was receiving retainer payments and still reducing their staff capacity, then our retainer payments are not really going to plug the need that is pretty critical in the Medicaid program, which is to ensure service provision to Medicaid beneficiaries. So we saw that as a pretty critical guardrail. The numbers and the percentages of, you know, of what kind of dollar amounts a particular provider is getting is going to happen outside the purview of CMS. But we are certainly able to provide the states with technical assistance to make sure all those guardrails are understood. And if there are particular questions, you know, that a state has for us to make sure they're interpreting all their decision points correctly, you know, we are certainly available to provide that too. But it's also an exercise of at the provider level, looking around at all the available funding streams, including Medicaid, the possibility of Medicaid retainer payments, and then looking at how each of those funding streams can be accessed for what purpose, and making sure that you're staying on the right side of the Medicaid guardrails, you know, to ensure the validity of your of a provider's receipt of those retainer payments. It's a lot, you know, to keep in mind, but we are certainly here to provide some ongoing TA and analysis for you.
Thank you. Yes, a number of providers access the PPP program. And mm-hmm. So the questions began to roll in, is that a duplicate use? I received PPE and I received retainer. Is the state going to claw back any of those dollars from me now? I can evidence where they were spent, but am I in jeopardy? Those were the questions we had begun to receive. But thank you for your guidance.
Yeah, and, you know, I imagine that, you know, everyone is wanting to do the right thing. The providers are wanting to do the right thing. The states are wanting to do the right thing. And, you know, that's where our a little more individualized technical assistance to really roll up our sleeves and understand the specific nuanced questions that are relevant for your state, for your group of providers, is something we're very willing to do.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Stephen Castellino. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Stephen Costantino, Delaware Health and Social Services. Thank you for doing this. It's been very helpful. Question on the provider relief funds for CHIP and Medicaid, the last round. Did you say, just want a clarification, did you say only 2% of the eligible providers have actually applied for that? I just want to get a clarification of that.
Hi, this is Jen Bowden. Yes, that's correct. In most states, less than 2% of the eligible providers, or at least the providers that we've identified as eligible based on state files and TMSA submissions, that less than 2% have actually submitted an application. Mm. The highest rate in any state is 6.5%. And I think the average is somewhere less than 2% when you look.
So I have kind of two questions. Is there any sense that deadline would be extended? And second, is there a way that states could know which providers have actually applied? Thank you very much. I appreciate it again.
So the decision about whether to extend a deadline for any provider relief fund distribution application is at the discretion of HHS. And at this point, we haven't heard anything about an extension of that deadline. We'll certainly make states and other stakeholders aware if we learn that that deadline is being extended. And then, I'm sorry, can you repeat the second question?
Yeah, is there any way a state can know which providers have actually applied?
Yep, so there is a public use file that is available. It's actually on the CDC website, but you can link to it from the Provider Relief Fund website on the HHS website. So if you go to hhs.gov/provider-relief, you can navigate to it that way. There is a place that you can specifically click on to access data related to the Provider Relief Fund. And you can see all Provider Relief Fund payments by state and other filters on that page.
It's just concerning that it's so low right now. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And Steve, this is Calder. I mean, we're definitely concerned about that as well and are tracking and monitoring that very closely or in communication with the department to try to understand what's driving that. I know we've talked to NAND leadership about it as well. I know they've requested an extension of that deadline, and as we learn more, we will be sharing that.
All right. Thank you very much, Calder.
At this time, we currently have no questions in queue. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone.
Calder, would you like to wait a few more minutes?
Well, operator, do we have any last minute questions come in?
We have one question, one moment. Our next question comes from Blake Oakley. Your line is now open.
Okay. Thank you. This is Blake Oakley in Alabama, and it's a question related to it. I'm not sure you've got the answers, but related to the Provider Relief Fund, we pay state agencies, the Medicaid agency and other provider state agencies are separate entities, and we pay those entities, and they were on our list, but they have had difficulty getting through to apply through the provider portal, I think because we all have the same tax ID number. So I think we're assuming maybe that we have to consolidate all of that information into one application, I suppose. But the other part of that issue is that we have each one of those agencies in turn pay numerous other sub-providers who may not have exactly Medicaid provider numbers. So we're kind of encouraging them to apply as well, but considering the numbers, I'm not sure that it's showing up that very many of them are applying. It's just a very confusing process and doesn't really apply to how we operate and pay providers. I'm not sure who we need to go to express that.
Sure.
Oh, sorry, go ahead, Calder.
No, I was going to say maybe, Jen, you can connect with them offline. Sounds like there's some unique issues there that we can maybe get them connected in with the folks at HRSA who are running the fund. But go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I definitely would be interested in following up. But just in general, the entity that has the Billington is the entity that would need to apply, and then they would have to distribute payments based on the requirements of the program and consistent with their provider attestation to any other providers that are eligible, to receive payments under that particular Billington. But we can follow up with you on your specific questions. You repeat your name and then we'll follow up?
Blake Oakley, Alabama. Need my email or phone number?
Email would be great.
Okay, yes, flake.oakley@medicaid.alabama.gov.
Okay, we will follow up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Operator, do we have any additional questions in the queue?
Our next question comes from Amy. Your line is now open.
Hi, yes, this is Amy Bernstein from Massachusetts. We are beginning to think ahead to what happens through the winter, and we understand that the Appendix K authority can last for up to 1 year, and ours runs from March 1st through the end of next February. And while that seems very far off, we know we need to really think strategically and think ahead. We're wondering if it is possible to have back-to-back Appendix K authority should the need continue, or if we would be required to do traditional amendments to extend that authority.
This is Ralph, and I think the answer to that question really relies on how far this, how long the PHE and the pandemic lasts. So we would be able to better guide you, but we are prepared to discuss creating a new Appendix K if, in fact, the disaster lasts longer than that period of time. And I think it's really significant and important that you're thinking ahead like that, and we will work with you on that. There is an importance to ensuring that any kind of disaster relief has an end date, because the bottom line is there are a lot of flexibilities involved here, because it doesn't change the base waiver, which is why 1 year is the limit. But this is an unprecedented time, and we will look at the actions that need to be taken to ensure that the states and the individuals that we all serve are able to be sustained during this time period should it last longer than anticipated.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
At this time, we currently have no questions in queue.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining us today. We appreciate your time and the opportunity to be able to answer these questions. We'll be returning to our weekly cadence of meetings now, so we look forward to having you join us next week on the 21st, and we'll have information about the topic out soon. But, of course, in the meantime, between these calls, feel free to reach out to your state leads if you have any pressing questions or need any individual assistance. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.
Thank you for your participation in today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.